Thank you. First case today is United States v. Easterly. This being a certified case, the government will go first. Is the government prepared to argue? And the appellee? Government may proceed.
Chief Judge Dookie, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Major Ann Delmar, and together with Ms. Mary Ellen Payne, we represent the United States in today's hearing. Chief Judge, I respectfully request 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
This court should reverse the lower court's holding because the Air Force Court incorrectly applied the plain error analysis in this case. The lower court's decision was incorrect for primarily two reasons. There's no legal authority that requires a military judge to sua sponte give an instruction on potential medical retirement benefits under the facts of this case. And then secondly, there's no plain error because the appellee was not prejudiced. The member's decision to give a punitive discharge for attempted premeditated murder was not a close call. An appellate was not, appellee was not restrained.
Can I go back before, I hate to jump in so early, but I'll forget later on my question. Going back to the judge's sua sponte duty, now I understand that the defense, the appellant, is the accused, is basing it on his reading of Boyd. How do you read Boyd in coming out with the conclusion that there is no sua sponte duty on the part of the military judge to give this instruction?
Judge Sparks, the government's position is in Boyd, this court set out a very clear test that to sua sponte give an instruction on retirement requires a factual predicate and a request by the party.
But how does that fit with what sua sponte means? Sua sponte means of one's own accord. It means without prompting. And yet the government in its brief and just now, it seems as if you're saying that the defense has to request it. So that is with prompting. So I'm not quite sure I understand your position.
Judge Olson, I see two, first of all, one problem I see with having a standard that doesn't request or require the party to request an instruction is it essentially eviscerates Boyd, because if the party never had to request an instruction, or if it was always required, then why would they ever have to require an instruction? And the government doesn't see this any differently than other areas of the law where a judge may have to instruct sua sponte. For example, in the line of cases cited by Boyd, it's generally required sua sponte, if it's required. It's never been found to be required without being requested by a party. But when it is required is when, like, there's a question from the members, there's confusion on the record, Perhaps if one of the counsel argued that they couldn't consider it, there would be a reason for the judge to sua sponte give the instruction. But otherwise, to hold that a party would not have to request the instruction, first would seem to undercut the holding in Boyd, and secondly, it could go impede on the party's ability to present their strategy.
Major Grant, I suppose your colleague next in the desk next to you there is going to say, wait a minute, in Boyd they actually did a sua sponte analysis. In other words, they did a plain error analysis based on, seemingly based on a requirement that the judge would have had to have done a sua sponte, give a sua sponte instruction. In other words, I think, I don't want to speak for him, he's going to tell us in a little bit, but I think he's going to say near the end of the Boyd opinion, the court in Boyd seems to, after having talked about what the rule will be going forward, seems to have made an analysis under the plain error doctrine and assumed that there might have been a requirement on the part of the military judge to issue the instruction sua sponte. What about that?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's what is clear from the what we've taken away from the holding in Boyd, and I don't believe that's what the field has taken away from the holding in Boyd. We, in our brief, mentioned the military judge's desk book, where the field tends to be interpreting this as the rule from this court. And if that's not the rule from this court, it's not clear, and so it wasn't plain error. And if the rule is that it's required sua sponte, it wasn't clear for the military judge in this case.
Now I'm confused. What is the government's position on the question asked?
The government's position is the military judge is not required to give a sua sponte instruction absent there being a factual predicate and one of the parties requested the instruction.
Okay, so the government's position is you have to have a request.
Yes, okay. Chief Judge.
Okay.
We could say, well, Boyd doesn't make a lot of sense, right, because it's talking about a request in the context of sua sponte, right? But is your position that, regardless of sua sponte, that it's only error for the military judge not to give an instruction if it was requested and there's a factual predicate?
Yes, Judge Ryan.
I mean, isn't that a simpler test?
Yes, Judge Ryan.
Okay.
This court has also held that if we could point to a reason why there may have been a strategic reason for them not to request the instruction, then you wouldn't find that the military judge plainly erred in not giving the instruction. And in this case, the government can point to several different aspects of the
court. Whoa. I thought you just said no ask, no instruction. Now you're muddling around in, well, they might have used this as a strategy X. Well, they might have done a whole lot of things as a strategy X, but I thought the government's position was no ask, no instruction. And it doesn't make any difference why they no ask.
Your Honor, I agree. I think the nuance of it is there are, in the appellee's brief, they essentially say, in their footnote, I believe it's 19 or 17, they say, if the standard that we've proposed, you could never find plain error. And the government's position is there are scenarios if you don't ask and there's a factual predicate or you don't ask, that maybe it could arise. And I guess we're just conceding there could be a scenario.
Oh, then it's not no ask, no instruction. It's something less. I mean, leaving aside the substantial probability that we just messed this up and nobody knows what it means, I'm still trying to figure out what the government's position is, and I will ask the appellant or appellee when he gets up here the same thing, because now I don't know who's propounding what.
Well, I don't want to muddle it, Chief Judge.
Well, no, I'm saying we may have muddled it. That seemed to be an implication that when we did this last time, we messed it up.
Well, Major Brandt, you're simply saying the government's position is the holding in Boyd, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is the only law that this military judge could look to, and the way that we read that holding is if you don't ask for the instruction, it's not plain error. But in response to the appellee's proposition that there could never be plain error unless you didn't ask for instruction, we're acknowledging that there could be scenarios where it becomes so confusing depending on arguments during sentencing that you might need to instruct.
You're talking about other stuff now. You're talking about confusing the members or somebody getting the law wrong or something like that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're saying if you have these additional things that the Chief was just talking about, then there would be a sua sponte responsibility on the part of the military judge to give the instruction. Is that what you're saying? For instance, confusing the jury.
Yes, Judge Olson.
So here the military judge referred to the fact that the panel members should not consider collateral consequences. Might that not have confused the panel members about whether the retirement disability was a collateral as compared to a direct consequence?
Is the government's position, Judge Olson, is no, because his instruction was clear that any collateral consequences arising from the conviction they were not to consider, but the instruction on the punitive discharge went to sentencing, and the members are presumed to follow the military judge's instructions. So our position is there isn't confusion in regards to the collateral consequence instruction.
So I know I'm going to be beating a dead horse here, but is it the government's position that in Boyd we just didn't really articulate what we were trying to convey back then? I'm looking at a quote from Boyd where we say, "We will grant relief if the military judge's failure to instruct sua sponte was plain error." And we talk about that in the context of there being a predicate for the instruction. You're saying that, in fact, what we should have been talking about is only a sua sponte instruction is necessary if there's a predicate and more.
And yes, Judge Olson, and the more is the request. So the government
is the more simply the request? Because it goes back to the concern I had at the very beginning of, sua sponte means without prompting, and yet you're saying it requires the prompting by counsel. You seem to be saying to the chief judge there are other additional things that could occur in the course of the court-martial which could then require a sua sponte, meaning without any prompting, instruction to the panel members on this issue. Am I misunderstanding?
No, Judge Olson, and that would be in regards to any time there's confusion as to the law on the record, the judge would be required to clarify that for the members. So I don't think that is taking away from this isn't being a required instruction. This isn't a required instruction under the RCM 1005. This isn't a required instruction anywhere else in case law or the law. And so the only thing the military judge has to look to was Boyd, and our understanding and from Boyd was that rule that it seemed clear in the opinion that it required those two factors.
Well then why would you see the need to make any concession at all? I mean, Boyd didn't talk about any other confusing aspects or anything like that. Why would you, the government, need to make that concession?
Well, Judge Sparks, I don't mean to make a concession as to the bright line rule, I think, that's
right, but you seem to be making the concession that there would be these other vague or circumstances that might raise the sua sponte duty on the part of the military judge in a case like this to give an instruction. Why would the government need to make that concession?
I think, Judge Sparks, that is just pointing to that's no different than any other case, any other time there's that confusion. And so when
there's a lot of confusing things that go on in a trial. That means the judge needs to take over doing the counsel's work for him.
In regards to the law, Judge Sparks.
Oh, okay.
If counsel, I may, I see that my time is running a little low.
Counsel, may I ask you a question about the evidentiary predicate? In your opening brief, you say that the formal physical evaluation board recommendation was not enough to create an evidentiary predicate, and then the appellee says, well, yeah, but if you look at the DOD instruction, that makes it pretty clear that it was enough. And my question is, what is the government's position on whether we can consider things like the DOD instruction that were not presented or argued about at trial? Are we permitted to consider things like that?
The government's position is no. As this court noted in Perry, it was incumbent upon the defense at trial to put that information in front of the military judge in order to find, if they wanted to build the record for a retirement instruction, but they can't do so after the fact. And I think that's consistent with this court's prior holding in Perry.
It's not a source of law that is sort of accessible to everyone, that it has to be actually presented as though it were evidence?
I believe it's more complicated in this case, Judge Maggs, in the sense that there was other things going on at trial here. It wasn't just on its face those two documents. You had the document saying it wasn't recommended for retirement. Then you had it was recommended for retirement. Then you had the 706 where that wasn't admitted at trial, but behind the scenes throughout the whole trial, it was permeated with the defense trying to keep out any evidence that undercut those documents. And so it seemed that they were aware that was not, that may not have been the diagnosis in 2017 when this went to trial. If I could just briefly talk about prejudice, the lower court misapplied the prejudice analysis in this case, stating that the members were deprived of considering everything that they could have, and that's just not the standard. It's whether the sentence was substantially influenced by this error. And the government's concern is that AFCA has essentially applied this per se standard that if this instruction wasn't given, it is prejudicial.
So on rebuttal, could you please address the question of waiver, meaning that if this is not required instruction, if it's not a required instruction, why isn't failure to request it at trial waiver?
Yes, Judge Ryan. If I could just, I see I have a little bit more time.
Remember, you're not required to use it. Mm-hmm.
Our prejudice case here is pretty strong. First, because this wasn't a close call. This was an attempted murder case where the individual showed up at the door with a kill bag, and if she had opened that door, she would have been dead. And the members gave him the additional stigma of a dishonorable discharge. I see my time is running. I will finish that on rebuttal, if I may, Chief Judge.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the appellee. Could you start off by telling me what the appellee's position is with respect to the matters discussed with the government?
I will. Yes, Your Honor, and good morning, Chief Judge Suki, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm Captain David Chavone, along with Major Mark Schwartz. We represent the appellee in this case, Senior Airman Chase Easterling. Your Honor, the appellee's position is that Boyd is clear. Just because something isn't required under Boyd, as the length of service requirement was requested, and if there was a factual predicate, it doesn't mean that it can't be plain error. And in this case, and that's the latter half of Boyd that Judge Sparks referenced, that at the very end when it said that if not requested by a party, this court will grant relief only if it's plain error. Because
well,
the defendant...
Your position is it's plain error.
That's correct, yes, Your Honor.
Right, and that relief is available under the second prong, one might call it, of Boyd.
That's correct, yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Captain Chavone, in reference to that last part of Boyd, couldn't the court simply have been saying, well, look, we are about to change the law or set the law for this kind of a case? But for the moment, this accused, we're going to give him the benefit of a plain error analysis, which would include an assumption that the military judge had a sua sponte duty to instruct. But then, as the court says, all cases from this date forward will be judged by this other rule. Isn't that a logical way of viewing the opinion in Boyd?
Your Honor,
you see what I'm getting?
I do. Yes, Your Honor, I believe so.
In other words, you're going to give him the benefit of the doubt by assuming for his sake that there might have been a sua sponte duty to instruct, and we see that that's what they did, but they found no plain error. But they seem to be saying that, hey, wait a minute, on cases from now on, this is going to be the rule. You have to have a factual predicate, and you've got to have a request.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would say that the language of Boyd, that it does not state from henceforth that will not ever be, we're going to review it sua sponte.
Well, ever is a long time. I agree with you there.
Counsel, can't you think of reasons why a defense counsel would not want that instruction?
Your Honor, there could be reasons.
Isn't there a reason that the court might say, you know, that it has to be requested by a party because... Couldn't it be the case that members in particular, you might not want them reminded that if you don't give them a dishonorable discharge, they're going to get paid for the rest of their life?
Yes, Your Honor. And two points to that. In the Air Force Court's decision, it said that it was either the judge's duty to sua sponte instruct or to ask the defense counsel to waive it. Do you want this instruction? Which
Is it a required instruction in the RCM?
It's not, no, Your Honor.
So what's the ordinary rule about instructions that aren't required if you want them given?
Well,
request them.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if you fail to request them, then how do we review that?
So, Your Honor, that would put us in the plain error framework where at Ehrman Easterly's trial.
Or in the waiver framework.
Yes, Your Honor, in the cases, Boyd and others that talk about if not requested, it's reviewed for plain error, would seem to be that it's a forfeiture situation as opposed to waiver.
Well, it could be forfeited or it could be waived. I mean, we've had instruction cases in the last couple of years where we found waiver.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe in this case, if the military judge, you know, should have recognized the predicate that was there for the retirement and asked the defense counsel for an affirmative relinquishment of a known right, that is the retirement instruction.
Captain Chavon, why is it the duty of the defense? Why is it the duty of the military judge? Isn't the defense counsel, of all the people in the courtroom, best situated to determine what the needs are with respect to his or her client regarding any kind of retirement? And isn't he or she best situated to determine whether or not their client will or will not benefit from such an instruction? Why is that the military judge's duty?
Yes, Your Honor. The way that the pre-sentencing proceedings and even in findings, because his retirement was uniquely relevant in findings in this case, as a result of the alleged communicating a threat. But with all the information in front of the members about him being eligible for retirement, what he would get through retirement, lifetime payments, and the ability to receive treatment and medication at a military medical facility, the military judge is required to frame that evidence, that information for the members.
Why is that? But I'm asking you, why is that? I mean, defense counsel is best situated to know what's best for his or her client. I mean, the military judge, it seems, would be least situated. I mean, the military judge doesn't know what the client or the accused situation is outside the courtroom, but the defense counsel does, for sure. So why would it be the military judge's duty to put his or her imprimatur on an instruction on his own?
Yes, Your Honor, it goes back to the information that's in front of the members and that he's required to frame that evidence for them, give appropriate instructions on sentence.
But and you're saying that's according to Boyd?
And RCM, I believe, 1005, that he shall give appropriate instructions on sentence. But yes, sir, also that it can be error if the factual predicate is so significant that it becomes a substantial matter for the members to consider.
If it's that significant, then you're suggesting to me that there might be some ineffectiveness on the part of defense counsel.
And Your
Honor, if it's so obvious and so prejudicial, isn't that specter of ineffectiveness hovering over the defense counsel at that point, if he or she does not ask for the instruction?
Your Honor, where we are here is that the Air Force Court specified the issue, and the Judge Advocate General certified it here.
I'm not trying to beat up on you. I'm not. I'm trying to get it in my mind why it is. In fact, it doesn't bother me that the CCA certified this issue, but you're the guy on the spot. So I got
yes, Your Honor.
I got to talk to you.
Yes, Your Honor. And for that, I'd look to the note in the bench book that references Boyd and cautions the military judges generally, that even if not requested, it should be something that the judge considers.
The bench book isn't a binding effect on other services or even us.
Why doesn't this case present us with a perfect example of why a sua sponte responsibility on the part of the military judge causes problems? Here, you've got a young man who, there but for the grace of God, didn't kill this woman, and what you're saying the military judge should have done is said essentially to these panel members, hey, I know you've convicted him of this horrendous crime, and he's a young man, and all of you are going to have to spend 20 years plus in the military to get your retirement pay, but With this guy, if you don't give him just a BCD or a DD, then he's going to be able to draw retirement pay for the rest of his life. Why wouldn't defense counsel recoil in horror about the prospect of the military judge giving that instruction sua sponte? Why doesn't this case point out why a sua sponte responsibility on the part of the military judge causes problems?
Yes, Your Honor, and the instruction that would be given is that a punitive discharge would terminate the accused status, benefits that flow from that status, and his ability to become a military retiree. In this case, the panel was never instructed that a punitive discharge would take away Airman Easterly's permanent disability retirement, and I understand your point, Your Honor, that the members may feel a certain way about that. I believe it's different for length of service retirement and 100% disability retirement.
Which way does the famous Harvard Law School knife cut? Both ways, of course, but go ahead. I would think that the spectacle of a senior airman sucking at the government teat for the next 50 years because he was schizophrenic might, as was pointed out, cause defense counsel to recoil in horror.
Your Honor, the key point here is that it was aggravated by his service. So
it was aggravated? What?
Yes, sir.
I thought it was pre-existing condition.
Your Honor, it was a pre-existing
condition.
But the Prosecution Exhibit 24, the formal physical evaluation board found that it had been aggravated by his service, and that was the reason that he was 100%.
Okay, now we have, speaking of the predicate, we have an informal PEB and we have a formal PEB.
Yes, sir.
And they say two different things. No, yes. So is that a predicate?
It is, Your Honor.
What's necessary for a predicate? Is this just a question of weight or what?
Well, Your Honor, this court's line of cases in Greaves, Becker, Luster, that discuss knocking on retirement's door or...
Well, yeah, but that's knocking on retirement for length of service. This isn't. This guy's probably got, what, 4 or 5 years in?
Yes, Your Honor, but regardless, the military, and I'll actually quote...
No. Don't give me that. It's a guy with 19 years in, maybe knocking at retirement's door. This guy isn't knocking at retirement's door. This guy, if he gets retirement, is going to get it as a matter of pure grace, but from the executive and the legislature.
Yes,
so,
Your Honor.
So where does that leave us?
Prosecution Exhibit 24 established that...
That's the formal one.
That he was eligible to receive that retirement.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I don't think the government has... the government doesn't deny that, I don't think.
Well, Your Honor, it's in the government's original brief, the series of hypothetical questions that...
But anyway, it's floating out there.
Counsel, on that very specific point, the government just said that we're not allowed to look at things like the DOD instruction to determine how definite that formal recommendation was. Do you agree with that?
I don't, Your Honor, given that it's a DODI, we're talking also about a statute that talks about retirement. Regardless, though, in this case, there was no question at trial that this was the Prosecution Exhibit 24 established his eligibility for retirement. There was no need to
put that on. How is this different from the Naval Academy case where they said, well, you didn't really prove exactly what was going to happen with the having to pay back the tuition? I mean, it seems sort of similar because you had something here, but you didn't really have everything you needed. Like, you didn't have the DOD instruction before the judge.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, if you look at JA 355, there was no reason to present any more than Prosecution Exhibit 25. Or I'm sorry, Prosecution Exhibit 24. The military judge states, "Is it not the official Air Force position that absent this trial, he's being retired from the Air Force with this diagnosis?" The trial counsel answers, "Yes, sir." There was no reason to present any more than that because everyone understood at trial that that's what established Airman Easterly's retirement eligibility.
Who's the authority? Who makes the decision? Who makes the decision that says, I don't think he gets it, regardless of what the formal PEB says, or I think he gets it? Who does that?
The Service Secretary, Your Honor.
Okay, Secretary of the Air Force.
Yes, Your Honor. And okay. That is the same for length of service retirement as well. Both both statutes.
Well, yeah, but you're talking about voluntary service, or 20-year retirement. Yeah, because that's voluntary. That's voluntary and discretionary on the part of the service. Okay, and what you're saying is the deciding guy is the secretary, or probably, in fact, the assistant secretary for personnel, but somewhere up at that level.
Correct. And in length of service cases, if someone...
Well, it's pretty much automatic in length of service cases, unless they do a screen and you haven't served properly.
Well, Your Honor, but yeah. even in a case where an airman has 19 years of service, they still have another year to go. Where right. In this case, Airman Easterly has a document that says he is eligible for retirement.
Well, he said he's eligible for retirement, so he's in the position of somebody with 20 years of service. He's right, eligible, yes, but they don't have to retire.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why this permanent disability retirement falls just in line with this court's line of cases on length of service retirement.
Well, you're taking the oratory in these cases and saying it applies here, and it doesn't. But go ahead.
Counselor, can I take you back to the duty to instruct issue? And my question is this. Boyd, it seems to be a little bit ambiguous with respect to the 15 and a half years that the court said we have to have a predicate, you have to request it. And then with respect to the temporary disability issue, they said, well, now we're going to look for plain error because there was no request. My question is, in this very case, how could we say that the military judge committed a plain error by not instructing when our case law is so ambiguous on whether an instruction is required or not? I mean, Boyd seems to say both things, and I agree it's a valid issue, but it seems like it's hard to say that it was plain error to read Boyd as saying that an instruction was required when Boyd does say that, although it also says the opposite with respect to the other issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
In other words, if we had to write an opinion saying the military judge committed plain error by not instructing, how would we get away from the fact that Boyd said you have to request it?
Yes, Your Honor. So Boyd said that it is required with a factual predicate and a request. It also said that it could be plain error. And in this case, the substantial...
And that's what the whole problem is. Like, if we say in this case it was plain error not to do it, the problem is Boyd's ambiguous. And so how can it be plain?
Your Honor, if the factual predicate, the information, the evidence presented at trial is so great and such a central part of the pre-sentencing proceedings, it becomes a matter that the members need to have framed for them, and that's by the military.
Counsel, I think that Judge Maggs's point is that given that Boyd at best can be called, from your perspective, slightly ambiguous, right? Even if we were to adopt the position that you request today, why would the military judge have committed plain error when we can have this discussion about what does Boyd mean?
I understand, Your Honor. Again, it goes back to the evidence that was presented at trial and how central a part of the sentencing proceeding it was, but also that instructing on retirement benefits is not new. Boyd is 18 years old. It's been in the bench book. It's been updated in the bench book. And it even cautioned, like I mentioned to Judge Sparks, the bench book even cautions military judges to consider this instruction, even if not requested. It's something that's been around and military judges are well aware of. In this case, especially when he's telling counsel, isn't Airman Easterly eligible for retirement? Doesn't this establish his
saying
retirement?
It's not new and saying it's plain error are two different things.
I mean, an instruction that says you should consider it even if it's not requested is the exact opposite of saying that you must give it even if it's not requested. So, I mean, that actually, I think, further detracts from finding plain error, even if we were to adopt your position as to what Boyd should mean.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe the wording of the bench book reflects the various levels of factual predicate that could exist in those cases, that if it's such a central part of the pre-sentencing proceedings to consider, to give that instruction and at least ask the defense counsel to give up that instruction.
Counsel, let's assume for a moment that this court reaches the issue of prejudice.
Yes, Your Honor.
So during this court martial, trial defense counsel says to the members of the panel, essentially, listen, this is someone who has a mental illness. It was something that was exacerbated by military service. He couldn't, he's not responsible for that mental illness. And what is key here, members of the panel, is if you impose a punitive discharge, my client is going to be stripped of his medical benefits. He's not going to be able to get medication. He's not going to be able to get therapy and so forth. And we all know that in the civilian world, there are holes in the safety net. That's what was argued to the panel, and the panel still gave a DD. So why should we think that the argument about getting, that's a very compelling argument. Why should we believe that an argument about and give him retirement pay for the rest of his life would prompt them to do anything differently?
Yes, Your Honor, and two things in response to that is the government reply acknowledges that requirements for disability retirement are not well, not as well understood or universally known as length of service requirements. This panel was never instructed that a punitive discharge would take away Airman Easterly's permanent disability retirement. It's reasonable for them, for the members, to believe that a 100% disability rating from a service-connected illness that will affect him for his life.
So it's your position that even with that very compelling argument about getting him the treatment he needs, and trial defense counsel said not only for his benefit, but for the benefit of society, you believe that if they had focused on him getting retirement pay for the rest of his life, they would say, oh, that changes everything. Then we won't give him a punitive discharge. He'll be in for 7 years. We'll welcome back with open arms, administratively discharge, and let him draw retirement pay for 60 years. You think that's the way they
would do that? Please answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not unreasonable for the Air Force panel to feel a responsibility that this member went overseas, deployed, and his pre-existing condition was aggravated by his military service such that it will require lifelong treatments, affect his ability to lead a productive life in any occupation. It's not unreasonable for the members to believe that the Air Force then has a responsibility to help that member through.
Wait a minute. So now it sounds like we're back in IAC. You know, this, it's up to defense counsel to make this point. And the defense counsel, if this point wasn't made, if somehow this distinction would have made the difference between a DD and there, then it should have been made. It should have been made by defense counsel on the record. And no can see.
Yes, Your Honor, and the defense counsel certainly made treatment and medication the benefits that would come with retirement.
The whole point was, you know, this guy's a whack job, so we're going to take care of it. And the member said, thank you very much, and came back with the DD. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government. Do you have a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, how should we clear this up? What does the government think we should do? What we should say in this opinion that will clear up Boyd?
Judge Olson, the law wisely places upon counsel the duty to request this instruction, and I think this is a good example of a case that is a good reason for them to have to request it. There's multiple reasons in this case why this particular appellee would not have wanted that instruction. And so it's the government's position the test in Boyd is sufficient, that a factual predicate and a request would require an instruction. And that would be sufficient clarification. The test in Boyd stands. Judge Ryan, in response to your question regarding waiver, under RCM 1001.5 and the lineage of case law through Boyd, it says that this is not a required instruction, and it is reviewed, if not requested, it's reviewed for plain error. So it's waived absent plain error. It's the government's position.
So it's forfeited.
Essentially, yes, Your Honor.
But if the government's position is that there's no sui sponte duty on the part of the military judge, that means no error was committed. Isn't that the first question you ask under the plain error doctrine?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying that there could be forfeiture of this when your position is that there's really no error to begin with?
I believe how this court has interpreted waiver. So,
well, I'm not talking about waiver. I'm talking about forfeiture, because the only way you get to plain error is through forfeiture of an issue. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, my question then is, if the government's position is that there's no error here to begin with because the military judge had no sui sponte duty to instruct, then how could you even get to a plain error analysis? Because the first question in plain error is, was there error?
Correct, Your Honor. And I agree. I agree with what you're saying.
I think that would never be plain error.
Well, and I think...
Actually, I don't want to go down that road because you're going to start talking about what if people were confused. So I withdraw the question.
Well, I think I would just limit it to my conundrum here. And I'm just trying to understand the clarity of the government's position. Is that you're basically saying there's no error in this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, if the error would be that the military judge failed to instruct, then you don't have a plain error analysis. You see how that circular, you see my circular logic problem?
I understand, Judge Sparks.
You probably agree with me, but I'm asking you if whether you do or not.
I do, Your Honor. That it is confusing because the RCM and case law says that it's not, that it's waived plus plain error review.
Well, I don't know about waived. There's just no error.
Yes, right? Your Honor.
You don't even get to waive.
That is the government's position. The government's position is also that this case can be...
And I apologize, because I accept that our court has not been the model of clarity on waiver and plain error, but certainly if you have no error, you're finished, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Counsel, may I ask one question? Could you reply to the appellee's statement that a trial counsel essentially conceded that the formal recommendation was that he was retirement eligible?
Yes, Judge Maggs. Your Honor, I see that my time is run, if I may answer.
Please answer the question.
The government does not concede that we conceded at trial that that was the case. If you look at the context of that conversation with the military judge asks, isn't it true that at that time you were prepared to retire him? And the trial counsel says, Your Honor, you can't divorce that from the fact that a few months later there was a 706 held where he was found not to have a schizophrenic personality disorder. And so the trial counsel did not concede that, but instead said there's other things out here which the judge... the defense throughout the whole trial tried to keep out the fact that that wasn't the case anymore. Your Honor, if I may briefly conclude, if there's no further questions.
Thank you. Go ahead.
This court should reverse lower court's holding and find there is no plain error. The appellant never requested instruction as required by Boyd. The military judge did not plainly err because no law required him to give a sua sponte instruction. But this case can be resolved on prejudice because it wasn't a close call, and the appellant was not constrained in putting on his sentencing case.
Counsel, wouldn't it be better for us to resolve the question as opposed to deciding it on a lack of prejudice?
It would be good if this court could give the field some clarity, but at the end of the day, it could be resolved by just the third prong. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court is now in recess until 1:00 today.